Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have a show I've been waiting for a long time, a long-anticipated guest, and in some ways a living legend in media criticism and in journalism. We're going to be joined today by Danny Schechter, the news dissector, the executive editor of MediaChannel.org, author, journalist, and media critic for the past four decades. We'll be discussing the state of the media today, the coverage of the war in Iraq, and the general nature of news in 2005 and beyond. So join us today on Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Public airwaves that would otherwise have been used for new low-power FM community radio stations has instead been snapped up by speculators and is being sold off piecemeal to the highest bidder. The scandal began in 2003 when the FCC opened up an application window for FM translator stations. These are stations broadcasting with 250 watts of power or less that are limited by law to acting as repeaters for other broadcast outlets. Non-commercial broadcasters even feed translators via satellite. Several religious broadcast conglomerates have built national radio networks this way, utilizing hundreds of translator stations to do it. During the 2003 translator application window, more than 13,000 applications were filed. Had the FCC approved them all, it would have doubled the number of licensed radio stations in America overnight. Pete Tredish, founder of the Prometheus Radio Project, notes that of this application avalanche, two companies accounted for one-third of all the filings.
Radio Assist Ministry and Edgewater Broadcasting have applied for over 4,000 of the spots that would have been used for low-power radio stations in the United States.
But it gets even stranger. Radio Assist Ministries and Edgewater Broadcasting appear to be one and the same. They share a common mailing address in Twin Falls, Idaho. Since 2003, the FCC has issued more than 1,000 FM translator construction permits to Radio Assist and Edgewater combined. According to FCC records, Edgewater and Radio Assist have since disposed of 83 translator construction permits. Many of them were sold, netting a cool $803,000.
They generally sell them for about $6,000 for very rural areas. Medium areas, they sell them for $10,000, and slightly more populated areas, they go for $14,000 a piece.
Several of these permits were bought by incumbent religious broadcasters with large networks of translator stations already in place. In fact, the person behind the Edgewater/Radio Assist corporate entity is a former employee of Calvary Chapel of Twin Falls, Idaho. And Calvary Chapel bought 26 of Edgewater/Radio Assist's translator station construction permits, adding to the 350-plus translator station network it already has. Even more suspicious, those transactions were conducted via a shell corporation. Pete Tredish says it doesn't appear like any of this is illegal, but
I do think it's a perversion of the intent of the translator rules. It's a perversion of the job of the FCC to allow this sort of thing to go forward.
A pending rulemaking at the FCC and legislation on Capitol Hill both propose to expand the low-power community radio service, but the spectrum that's already been gobbled up by FM translator stations represents thousands of lost opportunities for true community radio.
As broadcast media makes the move from analog to digital, corporate content creators are looking to lock down their programming. Currently, it's no crime to tape a TV show or record songs off the radio. That practice, known as time shifting, has been upheld in the courts as proper employment of the fair use provision of U.S. copyright law. In the digital realm, however, plans are in the works to encode content data with what is called a broadcast flag. Such a flag embedded in the data would make it impossible for consumers to record anything. The FCC has already ruled that TV receiver and recording devices must recognize and comply with broadcast flag technology by July. But a court challenge led by the American Library Association questions the regulation's legality. Arguments were held in front of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals on February 22nd. Art Brodsky of the open access advocacy group Public Knowledge, another plaintiff in the case, says the initial reaction from the three-judge panel was quite skeptical to the idea that the FCC's authority extended as far as this.
It was not delegated by Congress to take control over consumer electronics and computing devices. The commission had never in its history taken such a step before.
The D.C. Circuit has not announced when it may rule on the case. Other Freedom of Information advocates are conducting workshops to help consumers buy or build their own broadcast flag-free technology before the July deadline arrives. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has even released a cookbook of sorts, providing step-by-step instructions for constructing an open-source, fair-use-compliant DTV receiver and recorder. Presumably, building such a system after the July deadline would run afoul of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which makes it a crime to use any technology designed to circumvent a copyright protection system.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, here in WILL AM 580. Before we go to today's guest, who's waiting patiently on the phone line, I want to just update you, my wonderful listeners, on the status of the pledge drive from a few weeks ago. We've done two tape shows since then. And just want to let you know that the latest figures we have is that our show in those 2 hours raised well over $8,000, or roughly 10% of what both our AM and FM stations did over that week pledge drive. So another just burning, barn-raising, hell-raising, whatever you want to call it, phenomenal performance by Media Matters, thanks to you, wonderful listeners. And that support is not only crucial for this station, but it's also crucial for programming like this to be sustained and encouraged, not only at this station, but at public and community radio stations across the country. So it is a very valuable donation that you've made and greatly appreciated. Fittingly enough, on today's show, we have someone who called in to help us pledge drive, pledge wrap, as we call it here in the trade, 3 weeks ago, and someone who really needs no introduction to people who have followed the media scene in the United States for any period of time. Danny Schechter is the executive editor of MediaChannel.org. He is a longtime television producer, independent filmmaker, media critic, and superb journalist. He's the author of numerous books, The More You Watch, The Less You Know. His memoir is one of the really fine books by a contemporary journalist that I've read. He also has a recent book out, Embedded, Weapons of Mass Deception, How the Media Failed to Cover the War in Iraq. And he has a new documentary on media in the war in Iraq titled Weapons of Mass Deception, which has also just come out. In his career, going back 4 decades now, Schechter has worked on a variety of things as both a media professional and as an activist. He was a civil rights activist and assistant mayor of Detroit at one time. He worked as a producer at CNN and ABC's 2020, where he won a couple of national news Emmys. There's so much more. We could spend the whole day, the whole hour, reading Danny Schechter's resume. Let's go to the man himself. Danny Schechter, welcome to Media Matters.
Yeah, just, my God, 4 decades. What happened?
I know.
Like from the 60s to 60. Boom, you know.
It's the truth, Danny. I tell you, and I'm right behind you. I'm in your rearview mirror. I'm catching up, too.
It's so funny because, you know, when I meet with young people and I make references to things, you know, and, you know, they say stuff like, you met Malcolm X? You know, and I realize, like, oh, my God, don't feel like this kind of historical museum piece.
Yeah, that's like someone saying, when you were that age, someone telling you they met, you know, Gene Debs or something.
Right,
it's
exactly.
It's like way out of the past.
Right, exactly. So it's interesting, you know, in terms of perspective, and it's hard, I think. I mean, you're a teacher to find those common reference points so that, you know, things that you're talking about, people, you know, don't just sort of go into what we call in media, me go, you know, my eyes glaze over, mm-hmm. but they connect with what you're talking about, you know, and finding that because we live in such a culture where there's no background, no context, no history really offered. And as, you know, a lot of people just don't have those reference points.
You know, I want to talk a lot today about the work you've been doing on the news media coverage of the war in Iraq. You've got the book, you've got the documentary, and I think, you know, you've been writing at your website, on your blog regularly about this. And the blog address, it's mediachannel.org, and then they'll find it there.
Dan? Yeah, exactly. It's the News Dissector.
The News Dissector.
Yeah.
And that name, I should just as a bit of preliminary background, that name comes, if I'm not mistaken, from your career as doing radio on radio news, doing analysis of the news media back in the 70s in Boston. Is that right?
Right, at WBCN Radio, right, exactly. So it sort of stuck, and it stuck with me ever since. And it's funny, I was once on a panel with a big media executive who said to me, you know, Danny, you branded yourself before the rest of us.
Yeah, but you didn't get rich doing it.
No,
that's the problem.
Well,
let's talk a little bit. I mean, we've done on this show, Media Matters, we've discussed press coverage of the war quite a bit, but never in someone who's done the sort of comprehensive analysis that you've done both in the documentary Weapons of Mass Deception and in your book.
Well, you know, before the war started, I embedded myself in my living room and I started watching, you know, the various channels, flipping from channel to channel, and comparing and contrasting with BBC, CBC, whatever else I could get, as well as internet websites. And I realized that we were watching a very different war from the war everybody else in the world was watching. Moreover, on our channels, we had a uniformity of point of view. No matter what channel you went to, you tended to see the same experts, the same point of view, the same set of facts over and over again. And later, you know, I reported that, you know, out of 800 experts on the air from the run-up to the war through the statues being brought down by the U.S. military in Baghdad. In that period, there were 800 experts on the air. Only six opposed the war. So there's a tremendous imbalance when it came to any sort of a debate about what was happening, the basis of the administration claims about WMDs, Saddam, Osama connection, et cetera, and so forth. We were being fed a line that was more selling than telling, more jingoism than journalism.
And Danny, you made a couple of really interesting points there I want to touch on before you go on. First of all, you know, when I've had discussions about this point with various audiences, people invariably say, look, we understand that Fox News or Clear Channel or Sinclair or one of these companies is going to be touting the government line and the pro-government position. But, you know, CNN and PBS and certainly NPR, these are very liberal. They certainly were not being pro-war. I mean, what does your evidence show?
Well, I think that's absolutely not true. And, you know, and I think this is part of the problem of the partisanship that has swept through the left and through America, you know, where it's easy to bash Fox News. You know, Fox News is explicit about its point of view and a caricature of itself often, and a great target. Out Fox does a good job of, you know, of clearly showing its biases, et cetera, and so forth. But in point of fact, Fox pushed the entire media system to the right, even more than it already was. And there was a similarity of coverage when the Media Research Center, which is was a right-wing media monitoring group, gave an award out for the best war coverage. Of course, Fox won on cable. But CBS, Dan Rather, who was always the guy the right loved to hate, won for network coverage. And don't forget, networks have much bigger audiences than cable outlets do. There was a consensus in the American media, A, that the war was justified, that Saddam represented a threat to the United States, that it was inevitable that we would have to invade. There was no other way to go about it. And that was reflected in the reporting, the pundits, and all the rest of it. Remember, there are three times as many opinionizers or pundits on American TV as journalists. So it's not just what's being reported, but how it's spun, how it's discussed, how it's interpreted, and how one point of view tends to dominate over all other points of view. And this is not accidental. This is, you know, you've explained why and how this happened in your many books about the history of the media and the structure of it, and the media consolidation and concentration we have. But this was a glaring example. What I came to feel was this was the end of journalism as we've known it. This was America turning into a state media system, very much like the state media systems that I had grown up, you know, hearing so many condemnations of, you know, Russia, China, you know, the totalitarian regimes. And we had the same thing, except it didn't look that way because there was different colors of graphics on the different stations. There was different music. There were different personalities. It seemed like a very diverse system, but when you really analyze the content of it, you found that there was much more agreement, much more consensus, much more complicity with the war than was realized maybe by many at the time. And this is what's so disgraceful. And McLuhan once said, you know, television is pervasively invisible. In other words, it's in our homes. We all have TV sets. We all look at them, but we don't realize how it affects us. Most Americans say, I'm not affected by anything. I make up my own mind about everything. But then you survey them and find an incredible amount of similarities in viewpoint, even to the point of, 42% of the American people believing that the Iraqi hijackers were on the planes attacking the World Trade Center. Not true, or believing, even after Bush said he didn't believe it himself, that there were WMDs in Iraq. So what you have here is a very propagandized population, and you have a media system functioning as a propaganda system, and that is so dangerous for our democracy. War is the defining story always. It's the defining story in the lives of most journalists. Most of the big journalists got their start covering World War II or Korea or Vietnam. And now what we have here is a totally managed and manipulated process. And it's, unless you understand this, you can't really understand what's happening in our media system, in my view. And so I ended up writing a book about it. But of course, like many books, unless it gets a lot of reviews in the New York Times and other places, it's dead. And in my case, the New York Times was pumping for the war, and I was writing against it. So the book got no attention. And then I basically started out on this quixotic adventure to make a movie about it, WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, at a time when it was impossible to fund it, impossible to get any outlets to agree to run it. But we made it anyway, and the film is out now. It's coming out on DVD March 8th. So it's going to be available. And we already have something like 300 people doing screenings on March 20th, which is the anniversary of the war to fight lies with truth. That's the name of the effort that we're making. And more than 2,000 people have already reserved it on our website, which is WMDthefilm.com. So we're trying to get it out. And fortunately and happily, there has been some receptivity to it. We've won awards at film festivals. It's been written up in a lot of publications. The only really negative reviews were in the New York Times and the Washington Post. Go figure.
We're talking. Remind our listeners, you're listening right now to Danny Schechter, my guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Danny Schechter, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Danny Schechter is talking about his new documentary titled Weapons of Mass Deception about the media coverage of the war in Iraq. Also has a book out, Embedded, Weapons of Mass Deception, How the Media Failed to Cover the War in Iraq. And we'll be talking about that and a host of other issues during our program today. Schechter, as many of you know, one of the premier media critics and journalists of our times, and equipped to discuss virtually any issue that you want to discuss. Danny, let me...
Just wind me up,
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Danny, shut me up also. Okay.
Let me ask you, made another reference at the beginning about the difference between the vision of the war, what was going on in Iraq leading up to the war, and I assume since then, from the U.S. news media compared to the media basically everywhere else in the world. Can you elaborate on that a little more? Because I think for Americans who only consume primarily U.S. news media, this might be sort of a shock.
Well, today I was on the air on CNN International. CNN actually invited me for the first time in a long time to be on a program called International Correspondent with the Reuters bureau chief from Baghdad. And he was basically saying, look, he's doing this hard job and his team in covering all these stories at great risk, seemed annoyed by my criticisms. And I pointed out to him, I support your efforts entirely. However, a lot of what you're reporting is not being covered and not being reported on in the U.S. media, whereas it is being reported on in other countries throughout the world. And that what we've tended to see is that news kind of relates a narrative of what the editors, what the people in charge of our media think Americans need to know, how to understand what's going on. Example, I was trying to get USA Today to write about my film, and there's a writer there who did a very nice column about me when The More You Watch, The Less You Know came out. So I called him up. I said, hey, Peter, my film is out, et cetera, so forth. And he said to me, did you see our paper today? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, the headlines were red, white, and blue. The Iraq election we've been playing it up and hyping it. It's like we need some good news for a change, you know. So of course, you know, he said I could never get it in the paper now, you know, reporting, you know, about on a film that's critiquing the media. And this is the kind of pressures that journalists face. I deal with them every single day. And I've been trying to bring this battle into the media to actually confront journalists and media managers. Most avoid it, but I do have in my film some interesting confrontations, you know, with Tom Brokaw, with a news manager at ABC News, and others.
Danny, you know, the core arguments prior to the war, as you know better than anyone, and as you document in the film, concerned weapons of mass destruction that Iraq allegedly held, and we now know did not hold at the time, and also the sort of link between Iraq and the 9/11 attacks, which we also know is bogus. But since those claims have been proven bogus, the major argument now on behalf of the invasion and occupation of Iraq that we hear today is that it's all about creating a much more democratic Iraq and a much more democratic Middle East. It's a really benevolent process to sort of create much more enlightened liberal societies than what existed there before as the justification for the invasion. You've done a lot of work over your career. In fact, I think you've been a journalist almost more than any other, singularly, who's dealt with human rights issues and abuses of governments of people around the world, all types of governments, be they left, right, center. What is your take on this explanation for the U.S.?
Well, it's bogus, you know, really bogus. First of all, we started a show called Rights and Wrongs, Human Rights Television, back in the early 90s, okay? And we went to public television. We tried to get the show on the air nationally, and Charlene Hunter-Galt, then with the McNeil Lever NewsHour, now with CNN, actually she just left CNN, became our anchor woman, a very distinguished African-American journalist, respected by all. PBS Corporation Public Broadcasting turned it down on the grounds that human rights is not a sufficient organizing principle for a TV series, unlike cooking. You know, cooking is a sufficient organizing principle, but human rights is not. So we went ahead anyway. We tried to go station by station to get the show on the air, and Channel 13 in New York was our, you know, presenting station, although they were very nervous about it. In our first show, we actually had a piece about Saddam's human rights crimes. And they were so crazy about balancing everything because of PBS's concern that all sides be heard, et cetera, that this not be leftist or what have you, is that they insisted that we get a, quote, a response to a report from Saddam Hussein. So, they wouldn't run it. And this is like, you know, have you
ever, year was this about, Danny?
This was 93.
Okay.
So this was like, you know, have you ever seen a report on the Holocaust followed by a response by the Nazis saying, you know, this is unfair, you know, et cetera, and so forth? Never. At any rate, in this case, they were just using this because they were so concerned about being called on the carpet for being one-sided and biased. They didn't even realize that we were critiquing Saddam, you know. But the point is that getting coverage on the air about these kinds of issues before the run-up, before the war, were very difficult. Covering the sanctions in Iraq that claimed the lives of a million children, and in part because of Saddam's brutality, was very difficult to get covered, you know, in our media in the whole period between Gulf War I and Gulf War and this war. And this whole idea of the administration enunciating certain themes, whether it's Iraqi liberation or you're with us or against us or anti-terrorism or any of these themes, these are the themes that sort of define the courage, that create the narrative, a master narrative that all the reporting tends to fall within. And so you have the appearance of something, and the appearance of something, you know, it looks good, so therefore people believe it's true, like the statues coming down in Iraq. This was the defining moment after which President Bush said, mission accomplished.
Well, Danny, what about those elections? What about those elections that took place a few weeks ago? Were they like that statue that fell down, or were they the real deal?
They were a stage demonstration effect. And, you know, it's a bizarre situation because you remember Bush didn't want to do elections. He was pushed by Sistani to have elections. So, in fact, Bremer was removed from Iraq and they decided to have these elections. And, of course, a lot of the people boycotted them or couldn't vote properly. There were tremendous irregularities. It was said at the time something like 72% voted. Now it's less than 50% of the people who've looked at it closely. A lot of the people who are organized blocks of voters, Shia particularly, and Kurds, who were organized by their political parties to turn out, nobody even knew who the candidates were. There could be no debate during the electoral process of what people stood for. It was all a symbolic form of politics. And of course, the people in Iraq, when asked, why are you voting? Why are you braving, you know, terror attacks and threats to vote? They told reporters, and this was reported around the world, we're doing it because we want to end the American occupation. Spin that around in the United States, and you have Bush claiming that the election is a validation of our policy, when in fact people were voting against our policy. It's like an old joke where the guy says, you know, I'm an anti-communist, and the other guy says, I don't care what kind of communist you are. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a complete turnaround of what the reality was. So the people were voting basically to get the United States out of there and to create a new political situation. And ironically, the people who, of course, have triumphed so far are the Shia people who want a theocracy. They want an Islamic state like Iran. They don't want a democracy in our terms, but they're playing along with the rhetoric because they want to try to edge and push the United States out and not offer any challenge to the United States. I mean, Sistani and the new, you know, prime minister there, well, both of them, you know, were in Iran for a long time. I mean, this is their kind of culture, and that's okay. I'm not arguing about that, but it's certainly not democracy in any sense that we would recognize.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have phone lines open if you'd like to call in. The number here, 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about a lot of other stuff besides the war in Iraq, including Gannongate, and maybe even get to the Oscars and talk about that. But first, let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Indiana, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Yeah, hello. Keep up the good work. The thing that I guess anecdotally that sort of tipped me upside down is when, as you mentioned earlier, when we switched from the weapons of mass destruction and the other ancillary things that went with it to all of a sudden we're creating democracy. And as you mentioned even earlier, you know, I go through all the channels and radio programs, and the switch was made so well. That's what's concerned me, is that whatever's controlling that kind of operation on the airwaves or whatever, and there's no, you know, questioning from any. You know, I expected some of the nuts to jump in and start asking questions, but they even didn't do it. And I guess that's the most frightening thing to me now, in the sense of Orwellian things going on. And if you make a comment about that, then I would appreciate it.
It's all bizarre, but, you know, there's so much of it. I think a lot of people's senses are overloaded. You know, it's hard to remember what you saw yesterday, you know? It comes at us with so much rapidity, with so much slickness and casual commentary and people throwing out opinions as if they're facts. And, you know, it creates an environment where people are blissfully uninformed about what's going on. People actually, you know, are asked, like, what is the basis of your opinion about something? Why do you think that? They say, well, I saw it on TV. You know, that's their general answer. And in fact, a study was done that basically showed, you know, how many misperceptions there were from the different channels. Yeah, most of the Fox viewers had the most, but other networks also had a lot. You know, and this is what our problem is that we're moving from a fact-based, reality-based world to an image-driven, impression-created, storyline-driven world. And that's very different. So people kind of think in terms of symbols. They think in terms of, like, you know, Jessica Lynch, you know, the U.S. soldiers, like the damsel in distress storybook, you know, the myth from our childhood and all the rest of it. So the way people actually make meaning out of what they see or hear or read, you know, they have to run it through their brain. What else do they know about a particular story, et cetera, and so forth? If they know nothing, then the last fact, the latest thing they've heard, you know, makes sense. You know, Syria attack was responsible for the bombing in Israel, says Israel. Then, you know, that goes for a day. Then the next day, Syria says, we didn't do it, it wasn't us. then Islamic Jihad comes out and they say, well, we did it, actually. The same thing about the, you know, the thing in Lebanon. You know, whatever the first impression is the one that tends to stick. And it's often wrong. It's often inaccurate. The first story is usually wrong because it takes a while to digest what it means. And there's no time in our media system for that because everything is moving so fast because the purpose of news, and you're not going to believe this, really, but I think even Bob McChesney has written about this, the purpose of news is not to inform you but to get you through the first segment to the first commercial. It's really about selling, bringing you into an environment where you're going to, buy things.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number here, if you want to call in, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We'll get to the calls in a few seconds. Danny, before we go on, you just talked about the purpose of TV news. You've been in the TV news and before that the radio news business for 30-some years. You worked at ABC and CNN and PBS over the 80s and into the 90s. How has commercial news changed over the past 25 years, say, from your experience?
You know, first, you know, there was a saying on a local CBS affiliate in New York, you know, more news in less time. So we've gone more to like the headline hit parade, short stories. Second, foreign bureaus have been closed, less international coverage overall. Third, investigative research and reporting has been sort of dismantled. Fewer stories challenging people in power, exposing things that really, you know, not just exposing diets about, you know, this claim that you can lose weight and then you don't lose weight, but exposing things that really matter. And we have a trend now where most young people don't even watch the news. They're watching Jon Stewart and the Comedy Channel. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a trend around the world. I just read that Le Canard, you know, big newspaper in France, which is the satirical newspaper, has been doing most of the investigative reporting. The rest of the press isn't. You know, and so we see this trend going on around the world. And this is part of the consolidation of so few companies owning so much, so that it all tends to look alike and feel alike and often doesn't really, you know, satisfy you in terms of really understanding anything when you're through.
We're talking to Danny Schechter. Again, the phone line is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. This is WILL AM 580. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Yes, I would like your guest comments on two matters. One, I think we can infer from the thousands of innocent civilian casualties in Iraq that there must have been a better way to conduct the process. My question is, what was that better way, perhaps a blockade? And second, on another matter, this oil for food program, $62 billion debacle sponsored by the UN. Since Kofi Annan is the CEO, the head of the ship, he should have instituted transparency and accountability there, and I believe he should not only resign, he should be in jail for his colossal neglect. Now, you couple that with the ongoing genocide in Darfur, and they don't even, now they're trying to get the people to go back based on a peace treaty that's signed without even...
Oh, let me jump in here because...
Wait, Danny, let him finish because we want to free up our phone lines.
Well, as I say, they don't even have any troops there to protect those people, and they're encouraging them to go back. And I believe that not only should Annan be in jail, but that we should really consider withdrawing from the UN and start a new international institution. Your comments.
Thanks, sir. Now, Danny, before you answer that, let me, there's several parts to that, and I don't, we've only got 25 minutes left in the show, but the first thing I'd like you to answer is this whole civilian toll that he mentioned in Iraq. You know, there was a lot of controversy when Lancet published the study that suggested 100,000 civilians have been killed in Iraq as a result of the U.S. invasion. What is your sense of what the civilian toll has been in Iraq?
Well, I think there's more civilians dying than soldiers. We only hear about American soldiers. We don't hear about civilians at all. I think the Lancet study was pretty accurate. You know, as an estimate, it was also downplayed and suppressed in the United States media, so the scale of it wasn't really clear to most people. Secondly, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the war, and unfortunately I wrote down a lot of what was going on then in my book, you saw all these assurances about how clinical our bombing was going to be, how sophisticated, how accurate, how, you know, Tom Brokaw said, well, we can't destroy this country because we're going to be owning it in a few days. This was Brokaw's view. We know now that the water system was knocked out, that the whole town was shattered, you know, that people, that the reconstruction aid never came in there, et cetera, et cetera. And this speaks to this other point that this person said. You know, he doesn't really understand how the UN operates. This Oil for Peace program was initiated by, you know, the Security Council, in which the United States is the dominant member. And the U.S. not only approved it, but a lot of the money and wheeling and dealing was to get U.S. companies involved. Yes, it was a scandal. But less of a scandal than the Halliburton scandal.
Yeah, but Danny, let's back up for a second, because I think there are a lot of our listeners who aren't really familiar with this Oil for Food program. Can you explain what that was?
Well, you know, the idea was to allow Iraq to sell oil on the world market, and then the money from the sale of the oil would go into a food program to feed the Iraqi people who were starving because of the sanctions that were imposed. In other words, the sanctions were put on to Iraq to try to kind of weaken the Saddam regime, but in fact, the Saddam regime was doing fine, thank you. It was the people of Iraq who weren't doing well. So the UN came up with a humanitarian effort, so described, to allow oil to be sold, and then the money that came in would go into the food delivery effort. Nobody has really criticized the food delivery effort. They've said that was done pretty efficiently, in fact. What they are criticizing is people who have kind of made extra money on the side in the sale of oil, and money that hasn't been accounted for from the sale of oil. It was a kind of corrupt process there. Should have been monitored more closely, obviously, but the U.S. never protested it. The U.S. was very involved in it because the U.S. role in the Security Council gave it oversight over it. So this is another fabricated phony story that's been pushed by Fox News and others.
Isn't it ironic that this story is getting pushed by Fox News when the $9 billion that's missing from the U.S. account in Iraq
The whole Halliburton scandal and the U.S. reconstruction aid, which is much more money, is not even being mentioned. It was like a, you know, here today, gone to the tomorrow story.
And why don't you just conclude, if you can? I want to get to other callers with something about the Darfur genocide that he referred to. Because I know this is an issue you've covered very closely.
You know, I've done a lot of work in Africa, and I've spoken to a lot of people there. There's a lot of disagreement about what's happening. The UN did not decide this was a genocide. You know, there are people in the United States, right-wingers mostly, who are seeing this as a case of Muslims versus Christians, and that Christians are being wiped out by Muslims. They put it in a religious terms. You speak to the Sudanese, they put it in political terms about power between the South and the North. They also talk about U.S. oil companies that are trying to get into that area and are working in league with some of the people who live there. It's a bloody, terrible problem. The African Union, which is the African regional peacekeeping organization, is trying to get involved there and trying to help in that area. There is terrible violence going on. It is a crisis, but it's not in the terms from which I think your caller is referring to it. Simply a genocide committed by Kofi Annan. Ridiculous.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Danny Schechter is many things, a journalist, a media critic, longtime television producer for CNN and ABC, and then later producing a program for PBS. Currently the executive director of MediaChannel.org. He's the author of numerous books. He has a terrific web blog at MediaChannel.org. And he has a new film out. He's a filmmaker, too, titled Weapons of Mass Deception, that has received considerable praise from those fortunate enough to be able to see the film. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Danny Schechter, the number here at Media Matters and WILLAM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple callers patiently waiting, and I promise I will get to you. But before we get to them, Danny, I'd like you to just make a few comments, if you would, about really one of the great stories that's emerged in the past few weeks in Washington, D.C., which is what's commonly called Gannongate. And your take on that. Basically, explain what it is, first of all, and then sort of your assessment of what
well,
it means.
You know, during a lot of the presidential press conferences, there was this guy getting up there asking softball questions and, you know, basically giving the administration, the president, or Scott McClellan in the White House, you know, kind of a ball that he could hit out of the park. Isn't it true that the Democrats are deceiving the American people on this? You know, yes, it is true. Well, you know, it was kind of a shill. And it turns out that this guy was with a news agency called the Talon News Agency. Well, he turns out to have been funded by and been a front group for a Republican operation, possibly even with money from the Mooney organization. So this guy was not a traditional reporter. He was a, you know, basically a political operative posing as a journalist. Then it came out that this same guy was running on the side websites that were militarystuds.com and, you know, kind of sexual pandering, homosexual web, you know, dating sites, et cetera, you pretending to have army connections or military connections, very seamy, very sleazy, you know, and, you know, operation. Now he's become a blogger himself. He's going to get back into the debate, apparently, from the most recent things that I've read. There are people who are debating about whether or not he should have been, you know, a targeted, that it was like McCarthyism to do it. Others say it's ridiculous. My point of view on this is, how is it that the whole press corps at the White House for past 2 years worked with this guy right in their midst, and nobody there was curious enough to find out who he really was and what he was really doing there? In other words, he was right in the kind of, if there was ever a glass house, it's the White House press room. America's watching a press conference, etc. None of the journalists there bothered to raise any questions about this, and I wrote about this on mediachannel.org as a piece up there about this, because I think it's another sign of sort of the degradation of our news. The news is happening right in front of them, and they don't cover it. I mean, it's very consistent with the past, you know, where, you know, during the Watergate days, it was police reporters, Woodward and Bernstein. They were junior reporters, rookies, who happened to be at the courthouse when the Watergate burglars were being indicted, and, you know, heard them basically admit. They said, well, who do you work for? And one guy said the CIA, James McCord, and that led to the whole unraveling of this Watergate burglary and the links to the whole covert operations of the Nixon, you know, administration, which ended up bringing the administration down 2 years later. But it wasn't the White House reporters that sniffed out the story. It was police reporters, you know, who just happened to be there and overheard, you know, these disclosures. And, you know, this is what happens, that the people who are covering the White House become stenographers, you know. They're writing down what the president says. They're not asking really strong questions.
Danny, do you think this Jeff Gannon, and I guess he has that's a fake name he used.
Gluckert, yeah.
Gluckert. Do you think this is connected in any way to the broader Paola punditry scandal, which has emerged where the Bush administration?
Yes, I am, because I think it's a mistake to think that this administration thinks on multi-track way. You know, Karl Rove is a master strategist, and he's not just thinking about doing, when he wants to manage information or manage perceptions, as he says, he doesn't just use one approach. He uses a multiple approach, and that multiple approach includes, different kind of strokes for different folks, you know, military management, run your own channels, you know, embed reporters, plan information in the media, spin the news. I mean, all of these are different aspects of the same basic, you know, strategy, which is to try to keep the American people in the dark about what's going on and try to manage the news.
Well, some defenders of the Bush administration say, well, this is what all administrations do. Clinton was doing the same sort of stuff. Why pick on George W. Bush? It's just partisan bellyaching.
Well, you know, Clinton, everybody in power tries to spin and control media, but I think the Bush administration deserves an Academy Award, really, for taking this to a whole new level of you know, basically suppressing information, spinning information, inventing information, and the rest of it. And I think that they and the news media deserve each other in many ways, because they're sort of partners in this. They're complicit. I was just at a media crimes tribunal in Rome where they put the American media on trial, basically, and convicted, you know, it's a citizens tribunal, doesn't have any power, but basically, you know, there was evidence from a lot of people about complicity between the media and the administration, you know, in the war coverage and the like. And, you know, this is an issue that people all around the world are concerned about.
We're talking to Danny Schechter today on Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. Please call in. We do have time for calls, 333-9455. Toll-free line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
The subject that I want to talk about isn't quite as current as the things that you're speaking of, but majorly weapon of mass deception. In particular, the attempt by this administration to rule through fear. Are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, we're here.
Okay, it got really quiet.
Well, we're so taken by your words.
Smallpox and anthrax are two that, boy, I sure would like to see a lot more investigation of. The smallpox scare, thank heaven our medical community just flatly rejected that. I mean, this is a disease that's been eradicated from the face of the earth for over 30 years, and Bush is trying to scare the people of this country into thinking that, you know, we're all going to get smallpox. The anthrax thing, the Bush family has, family and friends, have so many connections to the Carlyle Group, which owns Bioport, which is the only company, from my understanding, that manufactures the anthrax vaccine. It was forced upon our military during the first Gulf War. There have been reported major problems with it, the manufacturer of it, the safety of it, et cetera. And, you know, right after 9/11, all of a sudden we have these anthrax attacks. Boy, I would like to see some investigation into the Bush family and friends connection with the manufacture of anthrax and getting information out to people.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much, caller. Danny, what do you make of that?
Well, actually, our company is involved in an investigation of the response to the anthrax scares that took place. I think many of your listeners probably don't know, but that there's a big effort by the United States called Biodefense, which involves constructing biological warfare labs to do the highest level secret, you know, and the highest level research in the highly secure facilities. Universities around the country are playing, you know, a role in this effort because there's money to be made from it. And in Boston, there's a group in Roxbury, black community there, that's been protesting the building of a lab in their neighborhood. And we've been looking into this, and it turns out to be a national program, which is as expensive as Star Wars, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's been passed by the Congress, a totally disproportionate response to the, quote, threat. At the same time, we still haven't had any arrests in the whole anthrax scare, which is, you know, rumored to have come from within the defense establishment, not from the Middle East.
All right. Well, they're talking to Danny Schechter today. And before we go back to the phone lines, let me let our listeners know that a week from today, our guest will be Jennifer Washburn, author of a new book, Universities, Inc., about the commercial and corporate penetration of universities, a subject near and dear to the heart of those of us in Champaign-Urbana. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Hi there. Great show as usual. Just was hoping you could comment on the president's recent tour of European countries. From what I was listening to, I listened to NPR on the radio, and it just seemed like they were very positive. A lot of the leaders were welcoming President Bush with open arms, and I just thought, gosh, is this the same kind of thing that Europeans are listening to? Surely not everybody shared that same viewpoint. So I just thought if you could comment on that.
Well, in my blog in the last week, I've been writing a lot about this and showing how it was reported on in Europe, how it was a totally different, you know, the big demonstrations there against Bush. The BBC did this incredibly hysterical blog about the trip and about how, you know,
Hysterical funny or hysterical like freaked out?
No, funny about the way, you know, the various side events to this trip, how Bush canceled a meeting that he was going to have with German people to hear from the people because the people didn't want to be told what questions to ask. You know, this was a completely manufactured event. In fact, the response that he got from Europe was characterized in the European press as meager, okay? In the American press, it was characterized as, you know, great new breakthrough for U.S.-European relations. I think it was a failure, although it was an attempt, anyway, to signal to the rest of the world that the U.S. was more open. Whether it is more open or not remains to be seen. We did get a good glimpse of some very fancy new high boots that Condoleezza was wearing in Germany. I thought that was one of the achievements of the trip.
Danny, you know, you've talked about this earlier, but it's worth returning to. I mean, back in the 60s or 70s or some other period, say pre-internet especially, you could understand how maybe a U.S. reporter would adopt sort of the viewpoint of their nation somewhat uncritically. I wouldn't defend it, and I've written about it, but it's understandable. And they might not until years later get much exposure to a series of alternative viewpoints. But nowadays, the same reporters who are writing this sort of stuff for the U.S. news media, if they aren't traveling in Europe and seeing the media over there and seeing a very different perspective on it, just sitting here, they can go to the internet and they can see how the Independent in England is covering it, or how papers around the world or news media around the world are covering it, and see that what they're saying really isn't sort of accepted anywhere else. I mean, how do working journalists, from your experience that you've dealt with in the U.S. news media, who are sort of presenting what is clearly a divergent view from so many other people, how do they reconcile? Is all the other people just getting it wrong?
I think they're blissfully unaware, really, of it, in part because they're under so much deadline pressure, and they're, you know, with a lot of editors who are saying stuff like, "Well, Fox got that, you know, we have to get on that story too." So, in other words, people are kind of cloning each other's coverage, and nobody wants to be missing the big story that their competitor has. So there tends to be a lot of conformity in terms of consensus in terms of the news perspective. Of course, the news is there. All the facts were there. I mean, I had the, you know, experience of being with Walter Cronkite at the UN the other day, and I gave this big speech, and Walter Cronkite, who I admire so much, nevertheless got up there and criticized me. You know, of course, he said, "You know, this young man is a great, brilliant journalist, but, you know, he's totally wrong about Iraq, because how would we know that the WMDs weren't there when our government was insisting they were there?" You know, every cab driver in New York knew they weren't there. Anybody who read anything else outside the United States or looked at the issue closely, but even Walter Cronkite, you know, seemed to have, you know, be apologizing for the media, which was troubling to me. And in part, maybe it's a generational thing. I don't want to come down on him, but I'm just saying it just shows you how powerful and effective media can be in framing what we think we know and giving us, you know, it's not just what we think, but what we think about, how to think about it. And we have to do a better job of basically introducing our listeners, our readers, our viewers to these other sources and encourage more diversity in our media. That's what MediaChannel.org is trying to do. That's what my film WMD is trying to promote, more diverse coverage and more work for viewers. You know, it's partly our fault too. We've got to take responsibility for our media choices, you know, just like we do about our food. You know, I mean, suddenly McDonald's is serving, you know, salads. Why? Because customers insisted that they didn't want to eat that other fatty stuff. They wanted healthier food. Well, we need healthier information, healthier journalism.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. If the corporate media is biased, and I would have to agree in the States, then I think another problem that's really becoming apparent is this kind of blog echo chamber. And what I'm thinking of specifically is this, the fellow from CNN who was fired. And how do we get away from this type of thing? Because I think what that incident with the, I think it was a producer from CNN, really demonstrates is that a lot of these blog sites can just repeat something over and over until people take it as fact. Whereas I would assume, and I guess this is somewhat of my faith in a large news organization, is that there is some checking. So, I mean, I think it's a difficult problem.
Okay, well, thank you very much, caller. Danny, let me ask you to start by just giving a little bit of background on the CNN incident the caller is referring to, and then maybe expand your call, your answer, if you would, just talk about the blogosphere, the internet, as sort of a solution to the problems of the mainstream media, and what role it plays in your view.
Well, you know, it plays a limited role, and you know, unfortunately, people are willing to believe, you know, in the absence of facts and information, they're attracted to opinion, and the blogosphere is a contested ground. I'm a blogger. There are many other bloggers, but many of these, particularly on the right, have created, on the basis of their experience with talk radio, kind of this echo chamber where everybody sort of speaks to and writes about the same themes. So it gives it much more the appearance of being, you know, the truth, if you will.
Now talk about the CNN incident, if you will.
Well, Ethan Jordan, I knew. I worked with him at CNN. He was the head of news of CNN, and he was at a meeting at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, in an off-the-record session, and he, you know, made a comment that he had made before, that American troops, had, you know, that many journalists in Iraq believed American troops were targeting them, and that a number of journalists who were killed there were killed by American soldiers. This was transformed by bloggers, by Fox, by the New York Post, into, quote, CNN slimes our soldiers. And Ethan Jordan was basically rode out of town on a rail. CNN started to get attacked, and they withered, and he resigned and didn't defend himself. But I'm defending him, and I'm writing about this. And actually tomorrow, TV Week magazine, which is the trade magazine of the TV industry, takes a commentary that I wrote detailing various incidents in which soldiers did kill journalists.
Now, will you be posting a version of that on MediaChannel.org?
Yes,
so our listeners should check Danny's weblog and his website at MediaChannel.org. We only have a couple minutes left. Let's get back to our final caller. Line 4, Farina, you're on the air with Danny Schechter.
Hi. I wonder if you could... I love your program, and alternative media is a great hope. Could you make a quick comment about the electronic voting machines? We've heard nothing, and then Ralph Nader seems to have dropped off the earth. Thank you.
Yeah, Danny, well, the Ohio issue. And...
Well, I think that you know, to my surprise, Christopher Hitchens in the new issue of Vanity Fair has a whole piece questioning the elections in Ohio. He was a big Bush supporter. I think there's a lot that we don't know about what happened. There was a lot of shenanigans going on there, and there needs to be a whole major investigation of all this. I don't trust the outcome. I don't trust what was said. I made a film about what happened in Florida, in 2000, and I know that elections can be manipulated, and I believe that this one was as well, and the electronic voting machines were part of the problem that we need to look at. Just one last thing. Are you watching the Oscars tonight, Bob?
Well, perhaps. Should I?
Well, I don't know, but, you know, I'm told already that Robin Williams is being censored by ABC. He can't do a satire about the PBS censorship of that cartoon. And he's been, you know, he was basically called on the carpet for it, and he's been forced not to do something. So, you know, living even the most prominent event in American television, the Oscars, is being censored. And that's going to happen tonight. So you're
telling me I shouldn't watch it because I won't be able to see it.
I'm not saying you shouldn't watch it or you should watch it, but I think it's something we ought to think about, because this, you know, we're not just talking about, you know, information or news that's suppressed that affects a small number of people. All of us are being damaged by this kind of media system. All of us need to get active and involved. Free Press, MediaChannel.org, other organizations are trying to create a media for democracy and democracy movement. We need to get involved and get active on this issue, and that's why I respect the work that you do so much, Bob, in this program and your efforts at outreach, and I hope that we can work together.
Danny, we've only got about a minute left. What I'd love for you to do is, in that minute, tell people where they can learn more about the film Weapons of Mass Deception and more about your work.
Great. Write this down. WMDthefilm.com. That's our website. You can reserve the DVD. We'd like actually to offer copies at discount to your radio show, so you guys can make a little money for the show by helping us get the DVD out.
Well, my people will be in touch with your people.
Good. MediaChannel.org is my website. I write a blog every single day on MediaChannel.org about what's not in the news as well as what is in the news, what others are saying that we're not hearing or seeing. So that's the kind of work I'm doing, books and films, and through Global Vision, our company, and we welcome people there, and we're very pleased that a young person from your university wrote to us to intern with us. Hopefully we'll be able to bring her on board, and we're trying to, you know, make a difference, and we can only make a difference if we work together.
Well, Danny Schechter, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been a pleasure, as always, to have you. Look forward to getting you back on the air soon. Good luck with all your important work.
Thank you, Bob, and you know, that feeling is you know, shared in terms of what you're doing, and I think if we work together, we can make a difference.
Excellent. Okay, bye-bye, Danny.
Yeah.
And listeners, if you would like to get on our weekly e-list so you can have an email sent to you, we'll have links for all the things our guests talk about. All you need to do is email our producer, Victor Picard, at vpicard@uiuc.edu, vpicard@uiuc.edu. We'll send you a weekly email with updates on who's going to be on the show, links to their work, so you don't have to keep a pen and pencil handy when you listen to the show. Next week, again, Jennifer Washburn will be joining us to talk about Universities, Inc. We've got a fantastic lineup of guests coming in March and April. I think you're going to love it. So I'll see you in 167 hours. Thanks, as always, to Victor Picard for producing the show. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In Champaign-Urbana weather today, partly sunny skies with a high of 44 degrees, southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Rain likely this evening with snow and rain continuing after midnight, low of 32 degrees, south winds 5 to 10. Cloudy and brisk with a 50% chance of snow tomorrow, colder conditions high of 34, northwest winds 15 to 25. And tomorrow night, cloudy and brisk with a 30% chance of snow, low around 20 degrees, northwest winds 20 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana.
It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.